People are always asking the question of alcoholics and drug addicts, why don't they just quit? It's a complex problem, but it's oversimplified by those from the outside looking in. Well, it's some sort of defective character. It's some sort of problem that they and they alone have. Why can't they just quit? And we're going to be talking about that today because there's a marvelous book. It's a must read, not only for someone who may think they are struggling or have a problem with this, but for family members too, because family members all too often are left out of this equation. Why don't they just quit? It's written by Joe Herzanek, and he's going to be with us in just a couple of moments. But as usual, with me today, the Reverend Dr. Dan Geeting. And I remember giving you a copy of this book, Dan, and then you didn't give it back.
I love the book, and I and you have worked in addictions for a while, but I have not seen, as I got the book, I just kept wanting to look at the next chapter because it's written in such a friendly way and so down to earth, wonderful illustrations, but the topics are just phenomenal, I think, and I just found that they gave me something I could wrap my arms around and say, aha, I understand what he's talking about in an easy form, but very deep in meaning and concepts.
If you want insights you won't find in any other book on addiction and recovery, Why Don't They Just Quit? We'll give you those answers. And on the phone with us right now is author Joe Herzanek. And Joe works in the criminal justice system and with prisoners in Boulder, Colorado. You have an amazing background, Joe, and an amazing story to tell. Thank you so much for coming on.
Well, it's great to be on the show with you today, Ned and Dan. I appreciate the time and really appreciate also all that you guys do for the recovery industry. There needs to be more programs like this.
How did the book come about? Why Don't They Just Quit? How did that happen?
Well, I myself am a person in long-term recovery from my own alcohol and substance abuse problem, and I've worked in the field full-time or part-time for almost 3 decades. And what I've found is that I'm getting a lot of calls and questions from family members or friends that can't understand why their loved one, why their spouse, their sister, their brother, their coworker continues to use and abuse alcohol and drugs in spite of all the consequences. So after years of contemplating this project and talking with my wife, we decided that we should just put this in book form and make it available to especially the family members that are not real familiar with addiction and recovery and the whole process and what's going on inside the mind of the person that's dealing with this substance abuse problem. So we wrote the book, we broke it up into chapters, we tried to deal with the issues that we thought were the most pertinent, things that have changed within the alcohol and drug recovery field over the last several years, trying to talk about exactly what works and what doesn't work and why. So that's how the book came about.
One of the things, the directions you took, you were talking directly to family members, and there were the three C's that you allude to early in the book, and family members so often, Joe, just don't know what they're supposed to do.
Exactly. The three C's is, within the industry, you'll hear this term, the three C's, and what it says is that the family member didn't cause the problem, they can't control the problem, and they can't cure the problem. So, and a lot of family members will think that, well, if I would have just been a better parent, if I would have gone to one more seminar, if I would have been a little more compassionate towards my husband, maybe we wouldn't be in this problem today. But really, there's a certain percentage of people that when they begin to experiment with alcohol and drugs, they tend to like it a lot more than just the average social drinker, let's say. And their drinking or their drug use turns into an obsession and a compulsion. And the spouse or the concerned person especially often with mothers and a teenage son or daughter, that maternal instinct will just say, if I would just have been a little better mother, maybe this wouldn't happen. And but really, that's counterproductive. People don't cause someone to become an alcoholic or a drug addict. It's going from liking their use to liking it a lot to falling in love with it, you might say. I've heard it described sometimes as addiction is that the person has a relationship with the drug or with alcohol, and it becomes the most important relationship in their lives. So you know, family members and friends will go through this process of thinking that maybe I was part of the cause, and then they struggle trying to control this other person's use, or even thinking that there's some way they can cure this. And really, that's not going to happen. This person that's in trouble needs to have their own little epiphany before real dramatic change is going to take place.
One of the questions I was wondering as you had talked about that, and as we look at the family, is the concept of, well, why does the average spouse wait 7 years to confront the AOD problem in their mate? What is going on there? What have you discovered?
Well, I think that family members and friends are sort of in denial, as well as the person themselves. In the very early stages, the addict alcoholic will be manipulative, and the spouse or parent will think that it's sort of okay to call into their job and say, well, they're sick today, or they can't make it to class. And this thing starts out so gradually, and then when it does become more of a bigger or a major problem, then there's also this sense of shame that goes along with it. People don't want to admit that they are an alcoholic or a drug addict, and then the loved ones don't, you know, they feel a little bit, a little of the same sense of shame in that, you know, I've raised a person, and this is what they've become. So they will put this off as long as they possibly can. If you think about, for instance, at a social function, if someone has had too much to drink, let's say, and someone says, well, maybe we should call them a cab or take their keys from them. I mean, this is a really uncomfortable situation to be in. Nobody wants to confront a person and say, you know, you've really had a little too much to drink. We need to call you a cab. As important as that is, nobody likes doing it. And this goes on with spouses and family members for a long, long time. And they will get to the point where they've been manipulated, and they don't realize how bad things are themselves, and they will just put it off and put it off and put it off until it reaches a real breaking point.
Yeah, and I think along with that, don't you see that sometimes in the family themselves, that as they've grown with the addict in this addiction, that shame factor is, well, I want to just help them out and cover this, and maybe it'll get better in time. We can work on it ourselves. And then finally, there's just so many consequences that they've sort of had it and know that they have to do something.
Absolutely. They will try lots of things with this hope and dream that one day this person is just going to see the light. But for the real person that has become chemically dependent, they are in this stage of denial. They don't want to admit that they are powerless to control their substance use or alcohol use, that they can never be a social drinker again. I mean, this is a hard pill to swallow. So you've got the person that needs to be in recovery in denial. You've got the spouse or parent, a close friend that really doesn't understand this whole thing, and they will just put it off as long as they possibly can before they have to confront this. Because when it gets to a serious problem, it requires some intervention, and oftentimes it's more than a family member or a friend can do. They need to get some outside help in this process.
Once they do get somebody to agree to some sort of treatment. There are so many options out there, Joe. And how does somebody know if they're in the right situation once they make the move towards treatment?
Well, first of all, they need to get some professional guidance or some help from somebody outside of their circle of influence, I guess you would say. You can call a treatment center. There's literally hundreds of them all across the country. And you can just explain your situation. This is what I have. This is what I've been dealing with. This is how long it's been going on. And then get their opinion. Most of the facilities actually have a lot of recovering people that work there. So they're not just there to earn a paycheck. They actually have compassion and empathy. They understand the situation. So to get some outside help is really important because sometimes, people, especially with adolescents, a lot of adolescents will experiment and they will abuse substances, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're destined to be an alcoholic or a drug addict. It's not a good sign, that's for sure. But there's a difference between chemical dependency and just drug experimentation like in high school or college. So every situation is a little different, and when a family member is concerned, it's just a phone call away to get some clarity and get some guidance on what may or may not be going on.
What is the difference between substance abuse and addiction? You know, what do you see some clarifying lines? Like you were saying, in high school, there seems to be so much experimentation and increase of things. And what's the fine line between knowing that there's abuse versus moving into that addictive phase?
Well, it's usually consequences. Consequences go from being mild, suspended from school for a few days, having the car taken away for a week or two, things like that. But then this person continues on to use and to use more in spite of the consequences. And then at some point they reach this stage where if they don't have their alcohol or their drugs or whatever it may be, they'll have withdrawal symptoms. There'll be physical, biological withdrawal symptoms. And at that point, they've sort of trained their central nervous system to expect certain chemicals in order for them to, what they feel is just to be normal. So, when does this happen? I can look back at my own use over several years, from adolescence into my late 20s, and if somebody would have said, well, when did you become an addict alcoholic? I couldn't exactly put my finger on it. I mean, it was pretty recognizable once it arrived, but the day, the year, the season, it's kind of like I had a pastor friend ask me one time or made an illustration about marriage. He says, well, when did you fall in love with your spouse? Well, I don't know exactly when. I know when I met her, and I know when we got married, but the actual month that we fell in love, I don't know. But I can recognize it once it's arrived. And the addict or the alcoholic is the person that continues to stack up problems, consequences become more and more severe, and when they're confronted, they often become very angry, and just back away, unwilling to even talk about this.
Taking a look at that from just a slightly different angle, is addiction, Joe, is it a disease or a moral failing of some kind?
Well, I may differ with a few people here. When somebody asks me that question, my answer is yes. It is a brain disease. The chemicals in alcohol and drugs cause real brain damage, not necessarily permanent. I mean, the brain will heal itself and repair itself as long as we leave it alone. But is it completely a disease that we have no control over whatsoever? I think that we do have some choices. And that's where that moral component comes in. I mean, once I know that my drinking and my drug use is going to cause me lots of problems, and I continue to do that with my conscious mind, I mean, I'm not making the best choices, but I haven't lost touch with reality either. I know what I'm doing. So I don't want to throw it all off as a disease like arthritis or diabetes, which is completely biological, nobody has control over. And I don't want to say it's a moral, you know, total moral problem either, because some people have this predisposition. They maybe it's in the family, mother, father, brother, sister, all have had alcohol and substance abuse problems. So if they tend to experiment, they're going to more than likely have problems themselves. But so there's this genetic component. But as long as a person is rational and has not lost touch with reality, there's a little bit of a choice going on here. And that's where I kind of say that maybe there's a little piece of this puzzle that's a moral or right and wrong issue just as well.
When we look at that, sometimes I'm inclined to think also that that's why the treatment of alcoholism really combines mind, body, spirit. And I remember in some Alcoholics Anonymous meetings or individuals that they would have some sayings of as being a dry drunk, and that the goal is to be happy, joyous, and free, and that I don't know that it would go on the moral character, but it definitely goes on the personhood of how to look at recovery affects all relationships, and that if you look at a perfect disease, it really affects everything from family systems, and it becomes a negative spirituality that will eventually, and a negative disease that just eats away their whole fabric and will destroy everything in their life. But also recovery is that beginnings of hope, I think. And when you're saying that, I can see where it's a yes to both those sides.
I agree. And it is a problem that affects us physically, mentally, spiritually, emotionally, relationally. Every area of our life, it's an insidious disease that sort of creeps its way in, and eventually it does. Our physical health will go down, our mental health will deteriorate, the relationships with those that we care the most for will start to will have problems there, and people will quit. Sometimes they'll stop their use, and you can feel pretty good just if you stop putting the substances in your body. I mean, the brain will just naturally start to heal itself. It's a process that takes time, depending on what your drug of choice was and how long you used and those kinds of things. But you can start to feel pretty good right away. In fact, it's often called the pink cloud, where this person has been using for on an almost daily basis for several years, and all of a sudden they have a few weeks or a few months of abstinence, and they start to feel really good. But recovery is a process, and it takes some time. You know, I think of an illustration. I live in Colorado. We recently had a big tornado up in Windsor, Colorado. And if you saw the pictures, the town was just devastated. Trees uprooted and houses blown off their foundation. And when the tornado stopped blowing, everybody said, wow, that's great the tornado stopped blowing, but there's a big mess that needs to be cleaned up now. And it's sort of the same thing with the person that's been chemically dependent. Yeah, it's wonderful that they've stopped, but that doesn't mean that everything's back to normal. I know that in my own years of use, I did damage to relationships that took a long time to rebuild the trust, and that's part of recovery. People need a support group. They need to be involved in actively involved in their recovery process. But the good news is it's not as bad as a lot of people think. Actually, when you start this journey of personal and spiritual growth, you start to feel better. You start to like yourself a little bit, and life gets better. Yeah, it's challenging. every day is not perfect, but you know, recovery is really kind of an odyssey in a way. It's an adventure, and people look at it thinking it's the most dreary, horrible thing that they ever have to go through. But it, really, once you get through the first initial stages of physical withdrawal, and you start to feel better mentally, recovery can be pretty exciting.
People often interchange treatment and recovery, and in doing that, they're looking for a cure. So maybe, Joe, you could explain to us, you know, going what is treatment, what is recovery, and is there a cure?
Okay. Yeah, treatment is a wonderful first step if you can pull it off financially and so forth, and most times you can. Many treatment centers will work on a sliding scale fee. They'll take part of the fee up front and let the person make some monthly installments on the rest. And if a person really wants to get into treatment, most times you can figure out a way to do it. But treatment is, it can be a 1, 2, or 3 month process. Most treatment facilities think around the 28-day, 4-week treatment plan, which what we're finding lately is just not enough. 2 or 3 months would be so much better. But just the same, 28 days will give the person a chance to really take a hard look at their use, how it affects them, how it's affecting their body and their mind. It puts them in a safe environment where they can be with like-minded people that are also going through the same changes and dealing with the same challenges, and they realize they're not that unique, that their problem is a problem that's shared by many other people. So treatment is great, but once a person leaves treatment, they have to follow up with some kind of ongoing support, and that can be for a few weeks, a few months, a few years, several years. It just depends on the individual, but some ongoing support while they transition from this residential treatment facility back into the real world, that there needs to be someone to encourage them, to keep them on this road to recovery. And what I have found over the years is, whether people like it or not, the 12-step programs are just ideal for this. They're free, they're everywhere, and they're all the time. Where I live here in the Front Range of Colorado, we have hundreds of meetings that go on every day, and those are groups of people that have the same common problem, and there's just really no parallel between one recovering person working with another recovering person. And is there a cure? So I'll just be real clear on this. No, there's not a cure. A lot of people, not a lot. Some people think there is a cure. There's books that say the addiction cure, and there's, I've seen CD sets of tapes and things like that that talk about how you can cure your addiction and become a social drinker again. But after 30 years of working in this field, I've yet to meet that person who was certifiably an alcoholic or a drug addict, and had struggled with it for years, gone through treatment, got involved in recovery, and then a few years later, reverted back to being a social drinker. I haven't met that person yet. And I don't know of anybody, really, that would even want to try it. Once you see how bad alcohol or drugs, the problems they've caused for your life, and you leave that, and you remain abstinent for several years, why would anybody want to even take the chance? But now, one of the signs of addiction is lack of control, loss of control. And I've never seen anybody regain that control. If it happened, I think they'd be on the nightly news. It'd be the biggest story in the country. But it's just not happening.
The book is Why Don't They Just Quit? And Joe, where can people go to buy a copy of this?
Well, they can go online to whydonttheyjustquit.com, or they can go to Amazon and order it off of Amazon. Borders and Barnes & Noble, if they don't have it, they can order it for you. But those are probably the best places to go. Independent bookstores, many of them have it, and if they don't, they can also order it for you as well. But you can go directly to our website, whydon'tthejustquit.com, go to amazon.com, and they both have it in stock. It's the same price regardless of where you go, so it doesn't make any difference to us. But it's available nationwide.
You can also go to our websites if you're listening off of our websites, which is drug-addiction-support.org or alcoholism-support.org. We have a link to that, so you can order the book online from our websites. And also, we're glad that you're joining us on Recovery Now. Some of you might have come in via the iTunes and the webcast there. So, Joe Herzanek, I just want to thank you so much for sharing that. The book is absolutely marvelous. It's a must-read, and thanks so much for coming on.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. Like I said, I've gotten some good feedback, and, you know, after all these years, this is a preventable problem. I mean, it's a problem that can be managed, and a lot of people don't realize that, that there is a solution. Not a cure, but a solution.
And to you listeners, next week we're going to have Joe on the line again, and we're going to be talking about a lot of those issues. Dan Gating, as usual, thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. And Joe, very refreshing to talk to you today.
You too, Dan and Ed. Thanks a lot.
Joe has had an interesting life, and he's worked with people in the prison systems, in and out of the jails, and has a marvelous ministry going on in Boulder, Colorado. And next week, we're going to be talking to him about that. In the meantime, understand, you know, pick up a copy of this book. Understand if you're a family member and you're concerned about somebody you love, there is hope, and there are resources for you. It is not a one-man show, and you can get lots of help. But I think Why Don't They Just Quit is a very good first start for you. So we're going to be talking a little bit more about that next week. In the meantime, understand that there is a God there that loves you very much. There is hope. Look up. It's there. God bless.